Hey there! Welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share big ideas, I share practical strategies, frameworks that I've used, I tell stories of what worked, but also those big epic fails and what I learned from that as well. I interview experts, and I do all of this because ultimately I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And one of the things that we talk about on this show is, what does it mean for students to engage in creative work in an era of AI, in a changing era full of generative AI, where they're gonna have to be adaptable and navigate this complex future? And part of engaging in this creative work involves also engaging in critical consuming, because critical consuming leads to creativity. And so today I want to focus on this question of, what exactly will information literacy look like in an age of AI? And I want to share four different approaches that we can take, solutions that we can think about as students engage in this vastly changing world of new information with things like deep fakes and filter bubbles and all of the challenges that they will experience in this new information landscape. In 2014, Microsoft launched a hugely successful AI bot named Xiexi in China. With over 40 million conversations, users often described feeling as though they were interacting with a real human. In fact, Microsoft founder Bill Gates described it this way: "She has attracted 45 million followers and is quite skilled at multitasking. And I've heard she's gotten good enough at sensing a user's emotional state that she can even help with relationship breakups." Oof, I kind of struggle with that. I won't lie. That feels a little bit icky, right? But Xiexi has published poetry, recorded musical albums, hosted television shows, and released audiobooks for children. In fact, she's such a superstar that it's easy to forget that you're merely interacting with a set of complex algorithms. Some have pointed out that this is an example of the Eliza effect, which is where we tend to sort of humanize AI chatbots. I can tell you, for example, that I sometimes think about Siri as a person, even though she's not. And I definitely think of Clippy as being anthropomorphized, right? Like Clippy, if you're not familiar, was the passive-aggressive assistant. If you were trying to write an article, it would pop up out of nowhere and it would taunt you. He would taunt you with these eyebrows that would jump up and down, and he would say, "It looks like you're trying to put a picture inside of a Word document. Good luck." And he was sort of the opposite of Siri. Like in Siri, you say, "Hey Siri," and she pops up. Clippy would just pop up out of nowhere. But we're getting lost in the weeds here. Let's go back to this idea of Xiexi. So in 2016, Microsoft, they're thinking, we need to capitalize on the success and introduce our own version in the USA. And so they introduced something called Tay, T-A-Y. Now, this was going to be the virtual assistant of the future, part influencer, part helper, part content creator, part counselor. But within hours, Tay began posting really sexist and racist rants on Twitter, which is now X. She spouted off unhinged conspiracy theories and engaged in trolling behaviors. So what exactly happened? Well, as trolls and bots spammed Tay with offensive content, the AI began to mimic racist and sexist speech, because essentially it's running on predictive analytics. It basically is predicting whatever it's being fed to it. As the bot attempted to learn how to interact with the community, it picked up on the mores and norms and approaches of a group that deliberately spammed it with really offensive content. And by the time Microsoft shut Tay down, the bot had begun promoting Nazi ideology, right? And so that's pretty dark. Needless to say, we could say ahead of time that they had anticipated challenges, but they did not see this coming. Yes, you did just get a dad joke there. Now, while this might be a more extreme example, the truth is that deeper learning machines always contain biases. There's no such thing as a neutral AI because, well, it pulls from a data set from the larger culture and will learn those norms and values that are present within the data set that it's using. And it's easy to miss subtler biases and misinformation given in the responses that we get from generative AI. So in some sense, ChatGPT poses a different challenge than Tay because its biases are much more overt, but still very powerful. So if we think about it this way, we know that people will interact with bots. They're going to tend to believe information that they see. And the research has actually demonstrated that people, when they interact with a chatbot, they assume that the information is more unbiased and objective compared to when they interact with a human. I've already seen this with people who say things like, I treat ChatGPT like a search engine, or AI can teach you pretty much anything. Again, it's taking on this notion that AI is unbiased, and that's kind of a dangerous place to be. In the upcoming decades, AI will fundamentally change the larger media landscape. Our students will inhabit a space where generative AI can create instant content that seems inherently human. If we think about the Eliza effect, they're going to be interacting with bots that may seem human but are actually bots. And they'll have to navigate this world of deep fakes and misinformation. But the truth is, this isn't entirely new. AI has been changing the larger information landscape for decades. And so before we dive into this idea of the deepfakes, maybe we should explore how AI has already changed and transformed the way we interact with media. Because ultimately, if we want to think about how AI will influence the future of information literacy, it makes a lot of sense to recognize how more rudimentary forms of AI, more primitive forms of AI, have already shaped our current information landscape. And so for that, I want to think about for a moment the rise of echo chambers and filter bubbles. As social media platforms emerged in the early 2000s, computer scientists designed algorithms to focus on relevance. For the first time ever, users began to experience an entirely personalized media experience tailored to their beliefs, values, preferences, search history, you name it. At the same time, users could also create and share content of their own without having to mess with the official gatekeepers who were making sure that certain information got in and certain information didn't. I want to point out that that sounds like a bad thing, but in many senses, this was great. I mean, for me, this is how I began blogging and podcasting and all of this. I am a direct beneficiary of this lack of gatekeeper process. But what we began to see was that there was so much information that the algorithms that were searching for relevance became more and more important. And so as that happened, we began to see the rise of the filter bubbles. For the last two decades, children have essentially grown up with a worldview shaped by AI in a more primitive form, by algorithms as they have by geography. And that's actually kind of a difference compared to other generations. Other generations, you know, you were influenced by your own filter bubbles. They existed, but they existed at church or synagogue. They existed in neighborhoods and cities. Well, now you have these filter bubbles that were happening where in a world of information saturation, the algorithms then categorize information based on relevance. They prioritize the information to be what you want, and that results in this filter bubble where you only see the information you want. The net result of that is something called an echo chamber. So instead of information going outward, in an echo chamber, the information is shared among those who already agree with the ideas, and you have this thing happening where information gets more and more reinforced in these echo chambers. Now, here's where the AI becomes even more important. These echo chambers, these filter bubbles, are often manipulated using AI bots. Typically, bots have used simple algorithms or scripts to create signal boosts, to attack people, to do things like that. But with generative AI, there's a very real concern about the human-like quality of this newer type of bot. In other words, these bots will seem and act much more human. And we will have a harder time figuring out, is this human or is this a bot? Microsoft shut down Tay when she spewed a bunch of Nazi rhetoric, but what happens when people engineer bots to emphasize totalitarian rhetoric or promote racist ideologies? We have to be concerned about that reality. On top of that, we also have this thing called the deepfake. With generative AI, bots can mimic the style of an actual user, right? That makes sense. But this creates huge concerns for misinformation and for catfishing. And what does that mean? What does that look like? So it's easy to imagine an army of generative AI bots that can skew public opinion with a tone of credibility or by engaging in these conversational tactics meant to manipulate a larger population. If you can imagine a dictator, for example, using these chatbots effectively for their own use, that creates some very scary scenarios. And part of how we develop our beliefs is by interacting with others. And this is especially true of children, right, who are often trying to make sense out of their world. Now, with generative AI, these bots won't simply like or retweet a post. They'll engage in full-scale conversations in a tone that can show a wide range of emotions, from authentic to authoritative to approachable. You get the idea. And so we're already seeing that there will be this mimicking of human interaction in terms of text. And so that's one type of fake, right? But now we have this thing called deepfakes. And with a deepfake, it's basically creating fake video and audio. And that feels especially new in terms of the next level of fake information. The term deepfake is a combination of deep learning and fake. It's essentially AI-generated video and audio clips that have been manipulated to look like someone has said something that they never said. On an individual level, there's a very real concern about deepfakes leading to catfishing. If you listen to the podcast episode I did with Alec Kouros, he described how deepfakes related to catfishing have been used to prey on teenagers who were falsely accused of sexting. These kids get panicked because the catfishers go after them. And what happens is it leads to extortion and is often, you know, fake images that are sexually explicit. It's a really disgusting thing that goes on. Another example might be if you can imagine a grandma who gets a deep fake phone call from her granddaughter about being kidnapped. And the scammer then makes out with hundreds of thousands of dollars. On a more social level, we have this issue of deepfakes and the threat they pose to democracy as people share doctored video and audio clips relating to current events. We've already seen examples of deepfakes with current politicians. I've seen this on both the left and the right. I'm not trying to be explicitly political here. And in some cases, authoritarian leaders will use these deepfakes to create propaganda that goes after political rivals, goes after protesters, tries to justify unjust war. You get the idea. And this is only going to accelerate as deepfakes grow more realistic. As Kouros pointed out in the podcast episode with me, down the road, there will be a more powerful tool. So you've got voice, you've got style, you've got video. In terms of catfishing, you've got everything that you could possibly need to fool people, whether it's on a personal front or something more political. So where do we go from here? How do we help students determine what's real in a world of disinformation and deepfakes? How do you keep them protected from generative AI catfishing schemes? How do you help them seek out new ideas and opinions when they're surrounded by an echo chamber? Well, I want to share some solutions. This is where I feel much more hopeful. Solution number one is engage in lateral reading. For years, students have learned information literacy techniques such as the CRAAP test, C-R-A-A-P. However, Mike Caulfield, the director of blended and network learning at Washington State University, Vancouver, coined the term lateral reading in 2017 as a different approach. To practice lateral reading, you might be conducting research on author or publisher of the original source material, and you determine if they are credibility. So you start with looking at credibility. This could include checking their credentials, affiliations, track record, all of that. And additionally, you can investigate the publication or website where the information was first shared. Then what you do is, instead of just staying on that same website or article, you seek out, deliberately seek out alternative viewpoints and additional sources of information to help you evaluate the original source. This might involve reading articles from different news outlets, looking at fact checkers, doing things like that. And then you finally consider the role of credibility. So you're looking at authors' motives, the reliability of the information presented, things like that. So what he's created is something called the SIFT method. It starts with stop. Before engaging in the information, take a moment to assess your emotional response and consider the motivations of the author. You then investigate the source, evaluate the credibility of the information, including the author, publisher, and website, looking for bias, conflict of interest, you know, monetary gains that might be present, you know, even is this a vague advertisement pretending to be a real resource? You get the idea. You look at the expertise of the topic, any of those things in terms of investigating the source. You then move to F, find trusted coverage. You verify the accuracy of the information by corroborating it with multiple reliable news sources, and then you trace the claims, quotes, and media back to the original context. So that is the SIFT method. And I gotta say, this works very well in formal research. So if we think about information literacy, it's great in terms of formal research. But the truth is, we won't always be reading things formally. And that's where there's a different approach. Lateral reading might not be enough in a world of AI. Jen Lagarde, and I have an interview with her from a while ago, Jennifer Lagarde, and she co-wrote a book with Darren Hudgens, but she has pointed out that lateral reading doesn't consider the emotional aspects of reading. We often buy into fake information because it meets an emotional need. Lateral reading also assumes that students will engage in media literacy on laptops while doing research, but that doesn't capture the way we often consume media. Students scroll through social media, quickly reading articles, looking at memes, watching videos, you get the idea. And what she says is we need to pay close attention to what devices they're using, what context they're in, what their emotional state is. And so she suggests a different approach. And this is the approach of that of the digital detective. So solution number two, teach students to be digital detectives. Jen Lagarde and Darren Hudgens use this metaphor in their book, Developing Digital Detectives. I love this particular book. It's from ISTE. It's a phenomenal book. Go check it out if you haven't seen it before. But they describe using multiple lenses. So the triggers lens, that's sort of your emotional response. The access lens, that's the you know, where are you accessing the information? Does it look different on a mobile device than a browser? The community aspects of the interpretation, the way people on Twitter, Facebook, whatever, are interacting with it. So that's your access lens. You also have the forensic lens. This is the one that we tend to think of with information literacy. There's where you are investigate the information from a place of curiosity. You're thinking critically about it. And then we have the motive lens, where the students think about the motives of those creating the information. And so like a detective, they consider why people might manipulate information, why there might be bias. Lagarde and Hudgens argue that the solution goes beyond simply developing a set of information literacy skills. What they need to do is develop these mindsets in conjunction with things like self-awareness, self-management, social awareness. And so they argue that really information literacy is a habit and a mindset. The digital detective approach recognizes this distinction between informal information literacy and formal information literacy. We tend to read informally and formally, perusing articles for fun. We tend to write formally and informally. There's a difference between a text thread that you send with a friend versus an article that you write or an essay that you write. And similarly, students need to use different information literacy approaches as they type on a device and think about what they're doing. So the goal here is to really focus on this idea of teaching students how to pay attention to the ways that they are accessing the information as digital detectives. Solution number three kind of fits within this as well. It's the notion of seeking out librarians. The media landscape has been changing for the last three decades, and it will continue to change. We cannot rely on older tools like the crap test. We have to be using new approaches and new styles. And this is why librarians are more important than ever. We cannot lean into a single model or process for information literacy. Our students will need to learn these skills in a dynamic and human way. Schools need to tap into the expertise of librarians in helping students learn this newer type of information literacy and develop it as a mindset rather than just a skill. I personally think it helps that librarians teach students a process of prompt engineering. So I did a previous podcast episode, if you want to check it out, called the Facts Cycle, F-A-C-T-S. And it's a prompt engineering process that you might use with students as they engage in information literacy. So the goal is to teach them how to slow down as they engage in information literacy. And this one is more about how you interact with chatbots themselves. And with this, we want to think about slowing down and just being more intentional. And that requires experts like librarians to really help students develop that as a skill and a habit and a mindset. The fourth big idea is to look backward, to go forward. I recently read about a future era of deep fakes and misinformation. With the democratization of media, people take on fake names and anonymity to trick people into joining their side. They could put words into politicians' mouths. And with the democratization of the publishing process, you could see polarization on the fringes and flaming angry words in the comment sections of newspapers. But here's the thing. That era, well, it wasn't in the future. It was revolutionary America. In reading a biography on Samuel Adams, I went through a rabbit trail of historical monographs and dissertations and journal articles, and my key takeaway, we've been here before. Newspapers of that era regularly published fabricated quotes and letters from politicians. They exaggerated eyewitness accounts. Authors took on false names and hidden anonymity. Many newspapers had large margins where people would write really angry comments that shifted into flame wars. There were duels that were fought at pubs over what people said in the comment sections. Others clipped out pieces of articles and they would put them in what were called commonplace books. And they would sometimes engage in, well, let's say, selective editing along the way. On a more individual level, it was a time of catfishing schemes via letters. Now, what did they do? One of the best solutions to this challenging environment was to engage in open dialogue about the media that they consumed. Often people discussed multiple sources that contrast greatly in the forms of conversations that happened at pubs and coffee shops. As a teacher, we can't have pubs and coffee shops, especially pubs. But we can do Socratic seminars where we encourage students to think critically about what they read and what they consume. But they also took on the role of being citizen journalists. I've written before about why journalism might be the class of the future. When students engage in this journalism process, they take on this mindset that's very similar to what Lagarde and Hudgens described as being digital detectives. But you also get a chance to learn how media is constructed. Think about it this way. You will learn more about soccer by playing soccer. You learn about art when you, well, create art. By encouraging students to engage in journalism, they learn how information literacy works by actually creating information in a way that is accessible and ethical. The key here is to teach students that this isn't new, right? We can look back in the future and we can say, what did they do that helped them through challenging times? And we can adapt those approaches to the new technology that we're using. In the end, these challenges are big. These challenges are real, but also these challenges are not going away. And as educators, we can be the ones who help equip students to become more informed and better critical thinkers so that they can engage with this changing landscape of information literacy. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you do one or more of the following? Would you tell a friend about it? Word of mouth is still one of the best ways to get the message out. Would you also consider subscribing to this podcast or clicking the like button or review button? Again, all of those things allow us to share the message out with more people. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day and go out and make something awesome.